You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we'll delve into one president's ascent to greatness. The year was 1862, and the president was Abraham Lincoln. As the year opened, the Civil War was underway, and Unionists were pessimistic about the war's ultimate conclusion, as well as the leadership of the frontier lawyer leading them. The First Battle of Bull Run had been a fiasco. Great Britain and France were leaning towards intervention on behalf of the South to keep Southern cotton flowing to their markets. The U.S. Treasury was empty, and corruption was rampant throughout the quickly expanding federal government. Even members of Lincoln's own cabinet was envisioning a continental America split into half, or worse, thirds, with California and Oregon going their own way, or worse still, each state or region creating its own nation, replicating Europe with its endless wars and intrigue. But by the end of the year, Lincoln proved the master of a factional Congress, had at least identified the military leaders who would later win the war, kept Europe at bay, successfully converted the economy to paper money, signed legislation which would propel the U.S. into a continental power by century's end, and set the stage for the end of slavery with the Emancipation Proclamation. David Vondrely is the editor-at-large for Time Magazine, formerly of the Washington Post, and the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year, referring to the year 1862. David Vondrely is the author of three previous books, Among the Lowest of the Dead, about our current death penalty system, Deadlock, about the 2000 presidential recount in Florida, and Triangle, account of the Triangle Garment District fire in New York City. Rise to Greatness was released at the end of 2012 and is published by Henry Holt. David Vondrely, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In your book, A Rise to Greatness, you write that 1862 was the year Abraham Lincoln came to greatness, and you document over the course of that year how some opinions changed from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. And it was also the year that you write that the Union was held in the balance. Could have gone either way in 1862. Of course, most historians write that 1863, especially that July 4th weekend, was the turning point of the war. Why was 1862 more important to the future of the Union?
Well, 1862 was the closest that the Confederacy came to successfully breaking up the United States of America. At the beginning of the year, it was the definite opinion of, you know, really the leading statesmen around the world that the Northern cause was basically hopeless. Lord Palmerston, the Prime Minister of Britain, one of the most experienced world leaders at the time, advised his foreign ministry that it was almost a certainty that the North would not be able to prevail over the South. It covered such a great expanse of real estate, more acreage than all of Europe conquered by Napoleon. They commanded the most valuable commodity in the world, a virtual monopoly on cotton. There really was no Union army to speak of at the beginning of the war, only about 16,000 troops in the entire United States Armed Forces. There were no trained generals to lead the Union army. And at the top of this overwhelmed government was an unproven frontier lawyer, very little, if any, military experience to speak of. His managerial experience was as senior partner in a two-man law firm. And people looked at Lincoln and really, they weren't sure that any elected leader could prevail in a crisis like this. But certainly this man, who seemed, in the words of his Attorney General Edward Bates, to lack will and force and the power of command, it seemed impossible that the Union could be held together. And indeed, by the fall of 1862, the Confederacy had moved into, the Confederate armies into Kentucky and Maryland. They were expecting the populace there to rise up in support of the Confederacy. And the European powers were preparing to intervene in the war to try to bring it to a conclusion with two nations rather than one. And we came that close to the death of the American experiment that year.
And for all we know about Lincoln managing the war and managing the internal affairs of the United States during this time, what he did diplomatically was probably as important and less written about.
Yes, the diplomatic piece of the war is really sort of under-examined. And one of the things that I tried to do in this book was to go back and see this process unfolding, not in the all-knowing view of history, the way we normally look at things, but as it appeared to Lincoln at any given time, to look at what he was thinking about, what he was saying, what people around him were saying and thinking. And really, at the outset of the war, and for the first year or year and a half, the danger of the European powers intervening in the war was one of two things that worried Lincoln the most. The other was that he would lose the border slave states that had stayed in the Union. And these two issues, holding on to Kentucky and Missouri and Maryland, and keeping the Europeans out of the war, really explain a large amount of his decisions and seeming indecisions through the course of that year.
And I like the way you describe that, because it does have somewhat of a journalistic feel. And I don't mean journalistic as in newspaper writing or anything like that, but the idea that you're examining events sort of in the way that journalists today examine today's events.
Right. You don't know how they're going to come out. This is one of the dangers of history to me, as we try to explain and understand why people did the things they did. We can't hold them accountable for the fact that they didn't know all that we know about how events were going to turn out. You know, to say, for example, that Lincoln was too slow in emancipating the slaves, which he did in 1862, finally, after a very difficult process. Well, that assumes that he knew that Kentucky and Maryland and Missouri would not leave the Union if he took that step. But he didn't know it at the time. What he did know, as he said many times, was that if Kentucky in particular, controlling that all-important Ohio River Valley, if Kentucky left the Union, he would not be able to save the country. And so he had to move carefully to hold on to the loyalty of that state. And so it's useful to put ourselves back in the conditions and the mindsets and with the, you know, information that people actually had, rather than the information that we've been able to dig up in the 150 years since.
Yeah, and the Ohio River was absolutely key, because as you write in this strategy, the European powers looking at it said, well, the Confederacy is too big. It goes from the Rio Grande to the banks of the Potomac to Florida. There's no way that the unions can control that territory. And what Lincoln, as you write, he says he knew that there were rivers, and rivers were going to be the places the way you move troops in. There weren't a lot of railroads, there weren't a lot of good roads, but there were rivers.
That's right. One of the things I had to do to write this book was learn some geography. You know, living in the age of airplanes and interstate highways, we've sort of conquered geography. But in those days, just the basic problem of getting from one place to another was a huge issue, and the easiest, quickest, safest way to move around was on the rivers. And Lincoln understood this. As a young man, he had traveled all up and down the great river system in the center of the country, along the Ohio and the Mississippi rivers, Illinois, the Sangamon River, and the Wabash, and he really understood this firsthand, and he knew that if he lost Kentucky and then across the river from Kentucky, Missouri, that he would have essentially lost the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, and even the Missouri River, and that with those highways closed to Union troops and to Union commerce, he would not be able to win the war.
One of the things that the book does a masterful job of doing is describing the tenuous coalition within the Union. We think of the bitter divide between North and South and Republican and Democrat at that particular point as being the big divides, but even within the Northern Union, there was this huge divide in opinion of what should happen as a course of the war. And Lincoln was really, you know, from very radical Republicans that wanted abolition now and wanted fire and brimstone retribution, to Democrats that were certainly more ambivalent about what was
they
going
on. They wanted to, the phrase they kept using was they wanted to restore the Union as it was, meaning go back to the way it was before this, what they saw as a kind of fever of secession. That means, you know, with slavery intact and all the old compromises in place. Yeah, Lincoln, you know, he was not, in those days, the man on the big white marble chair in Washington, D.C. We forget that Lincoln in 1862 was the least popular president we've ever elected. He got less than 40% of the popular vote in 1860. He came in with the deck of popular opinion stacked against him. And all through this year, when he was trying to save the country, he had to keep this balance between the competing forces in the North, as you put it so well. He compared himself at one point to a man crossing Niagara Falls on a tightrope, you know, where one false step in one direction or the other would spell disaster. And at the end of the year, he says, you know, I may not have made the best president anyone could be, but I don't think anyone could have done a better job than I have of holding this Union coalition together. And I think that's correct. I think he did better than anyone could.
Of course, we remember the cabinet as being a team of rivals, as Doris Kearns Goodwin put it, but it really more resembled a Great Britain's coalition unity government during World War II. I mean, there were Democrats, there were people who thought they should have been the Republican nominee, others who thought they should have been the Democratic president, or you know, and also there was this sort of provincialism that, you know, I have to have a Missourian in my government. I have to have a Pennsylvanian in my government to keep everybody unified.
Yes. I mean, in the beginning of the year, he had a big problem with corruption and incompetence in his War Department, and he needed to replace the Secretary of War, but he couldn't just pick anybody. He had to find a competent Secretary of War who was a Democrat from Pennsylvania. I mean, that's how delicate these balances were. And he had people working against him the whole time. Salmon Chase, the Treasury Secretary, was running for president in the 1864 election from the first day of the administration in 1861. And people would come to Lincoln and say, do you have any idea what Chase is doing behind your back? And Lincoln would say, I know exactly what he's doing, but he makes a good Treasury Secretary, so I've got to keep him. He had to have the hide of a rhinoceros to withstand the kind of criticism and backbiting and undermining that was going on in order to hold these pieces together. Several times in the year, his cabinet very nearly came apart, and had his administration collapse, the country would have gone down with it. And to watch him maneuvering and playing his political cards so carefully, so skillfully, to hold that group together is quite a lesson in, you know, practical politics.
Of course, this was also a year of when the war, the terribleness of the war, finally became evident. The first few battles were skirmishes, and yes, there were deaths. And the first battle of Bull Run in the fall of 1861 certainly let the Union realize this was not going to be a quick war. But it was in 1862 where you start seeing these horrific death tolls at Shiloh, at all sorts of battles, of Antietam, and later at Fredericksburg. Just horrible death tolls, and all of a sudden people know this is going to be a long war of attrition.
Yes. People had hoped or thought early in the war that one or two key victories would cause the people of the South sort of to come to their senses, and the country would be put back together. Shiloh, 2 days in the first weekend of April, more Americans were killed than in all the wars the nation had fought up to that time, put together in that one weekend. That was a shocking thing for the American public to go through. At Antietam in September, as you say, you know, more Americans killed in a single day than at any other time in our history, even to this day. Lincoln still worried, though, as he got to the end of the year, that the public really had not come to grips with this. He said at one point, people think this war is going to be won by strategy, and it will only be won by hard, desperate fighting. And so he had to go through this process of educating the public, and most importantly, of explaining, of laying out a clear vision of why this war had to be fought. Why did he need to save the Union? Why was America an idea worth preserving? And that, I think, you know, he really drew on his own personal experience as someone who was born in terrible poverty, had no education, no reason to expect that he would achieve anything in the world, but managed to rise to the highest office in the land. He knew that that didn't happen in other places or in other times, that this was the essence of America, the right to rise, that the Confederacy was opposed to that idea, that it was founded on a principle of some people being rich forever, the slave owners, and some people being poor forever, the slaves. And he saw that if the principle of secession got started, there'd be no obvious way to end it. The United States would break up into who knows how many pieces. And this dream of a peaceful country, a land of opportunity from sea to shining sea, would be lost forever. And so he talks about this at great length in his annual message at the end of the year, knowing that Americans all across the country would read it. He talks about it much more briefly and succinctly and memorably in his great Gettysburg address the following year. But he was constantly educating the country about why this struggle was worth the cost.
My guest today is David Vondrelli. He's the editor-at-large for Time magazine, the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year, refers to 1862, just over 150 years ago now. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, just as Lincoln was educating the nation, he was also educating himself. At the beginning of 1862, he's willing to admit he doesn't know much about military strategy, although he probably had good instincts. But he really didn't know, and he faced with a commander of his main eastern army, the Army of the Potomac, who, well, let's just face it, McClellan didn't like to do anything fast. Maybe not even didn't like to do anything unless he was forced to. He had to become an expert on military tactics. It was also a year of evolution in his thinking regarding slavery. His public pronouncements was that this was not about slavery, and by the end of the year, he realizes this conflict is about slavery.
Yes. It was one of Lincoln's great gifts, and he had a lot that made him the right man for the crisis, but his ability to grow and learn, which he had had to develop as a boy and a young man on the American prairie with almost no access to formal education. He had to learn to teach himself and to learn from his own experiences. He went to the Library of Congress or sent over to the Library of Congress for books on military strategy and educated himself. And he was a quick learner. He started reading on military strategy in December 1861, and by January, he was able to enunciate a grand strategy for fighting the war that really turned out to be to guide the Union philosophy all the way to victory, all the way to Appomattox in 1865. His idea was that the South had lots of land, but not so many men. The North had lots of men. And so the way to fight them was to attack at multiple points all at once and make them stretch their defenses to the breaking point. And this is what he did with Grant fighting in the far west and Don Buell and William Rosecrans and later William Sherman fighting in Tennessee and Georgia, South Carolina, and then, of course, all the generals who led the Army of the Potomac in the east. But they stretched the war out across the entire landmass, and that was Lincoln was the first to, you know, to lay out that principle.
And of course, also the blockade, which they didn't have a lot of capital, and it was to starve them of what capital they did have, which was, of course, through cotton.
Yes, and the blockade, the naval blockade, sealing off the ports of the South, is really misunderstood, I think, in a lot of Civil War history. There's an idea that it was not very effective, and that's just not right. The combination of the naval ships blockading, but then more importantly, one by one, the U.S. Navy managed to capture these key ports in the South. And so while there were certainly blockade runners, you know, escaping from little inlets and tiny bays along the South, the major commerce of the South was sealed off, pretty much sealed off by 1862, during 1862. That was the year that New Orleans, the biggest city in the South and their key trading hub, was captured by Admiral Farragut. And this had a crushing effect. You saw by the end of 1862, inflation in the South was running rampant. Food shortages and other kinds of supply shortages were starting to bite. And in that way, it was another example, not of the beginning of the end so much as certainly, in Churchill's words, the end of the beginning. Yeah. The Union had its ducks in a row by the end of 1862 and was in a position to do the long, hard work of saving the country.
You also say 1862 is important for a variety of other reasons, because this was the year that government somewhat grew up. Not only the Emancipation Proclamation, which we can never underestimate, but it was the year of the Homesteading Act, the Morrill Act, the Transcontinental Railroad Act, the Pacific Railway Act. This all of a sudden made us a continental country in many ways. It helped settle the West after the war.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, much of the future of the country, the future business of the country, had been, you know, stymied and gridlocked in Washington by the fight over slavery and the future of slavery. And when the South left, this new Republican Party, which had never governed before in its history, suddenly was in power and was able to pass a very far-seeing, forward-looking agenda for the future of the country. And, you know, my favorite of all those bills is the Morrill Act, which created the land-grant college system in the United States, a really visionary achievement, something unprecedented, to use the national lands in the West as an endowment to educate the children of farmers and working people, to create, again, this vision of opportunity, widespread opportunity in this country that has been transformative in the world. Very, very visionary achievement, and it comes out of 1862.
I want to leave readers with the description at the end of 1862. At the beginning of the year, you quote the Attorney General at that time, Edward Bates, who is one of these people who really didn't think if he shouldn't have been president instead. He really found Lincoln's leadership wanting and really didn't understand the coalitions that were involved. And he's one of these converts to Lincoln's leadership. And you start the book with his comments of how Lincoln is just not fit to run a country at a time of peace, much less war. But by the end of 1862, there is I would say this was a constitutional crisis. It was about Congress basically saying you got to get rid of the Secretary of State, telling the executive what they can do as far as hiring and firing a cabinet officer. And this is within the Republicans themselves. This is an inter-party squabble. And he does this masterful way of neutering this threat. And if you would share the story, what happened?
Well, the cabinet crisis is an amazing story. You mentioned Doris Kearns Goodwin and her great book. She calls this the greatest political crisis of Lincoln's presidency, and I think that's right. The Congress had been adjourned for 5 long, difficult months of the war, and when they came back to Washington in early December, they wanted change, and Lincoln's own party tried to force him to break up his cabinet, to force out Secretary of State Seward, who was really the balancing force against Secretary Chase. The two of them appealed to different factions of the party, and again, this idea of keeping his balance. He knew if he lost one of them, as Lincoln put it, the whole affair would slump over to one side, and he would, again, not be able to hold this coalition together. There was no one he could talk to because this was such, if news got out that this was going on, it would have the same dire effect. He had to just work out in his own mind the step-by-step process by which he could isolate this threat, expose it, force people to see how empty and how senseless it was, and yet leave everyone a way of backing out and saving face. And he manages in 2.5 days of incredible political agility to pull this off all by himself. And, all through the year, whether it's the tightrope analogy or he talks in terms of balance. And again, after he's held his cabinet together, he says, now I have a pumpkin in each end of my bag. I can ride. Again, this idea of balance, of the fact that in the United States, moderation is the route to presidential success. We are a nation, really, of the middle.
Yeah. Well, it is a fascinating book. What was the most interesting fact you learned over the course of researching this incredible year in our history?
Oh, my gosh. There were so many interesting details and tidbits. I loved what a gearhead, what a geek Lincoln was. He loved new inventions and was constantly, tinkering with guns and bullets and bombs that people were bringing. If they didn't get a hearing at the War Office, they would come over to the White House and ask Lincoln to intervene. He commissioned his own scientific experiments, looking for a better form of gunpowder, and he superintended that himself. He was the guy who got the ironclads, the Monitor, and other ironclad gunboats underway and pushed the Navy Department to get that project done. I loved that about him. There were very heartbreaking moments because this was the year Lincoln lost his favorite son, Willie, to typhoid fever. His wife had a nervous breakdown under the grief. It was a terribly difficult year for him personally as well.
And yet he was able to compartmentalize everything. The fun fact I learned was the fact that he actually did a bit of scouting himself. He went down to the York Peninsula, was looking for places where they could land a force, and he took several cabinet secretaries with him. This is crazy, unheard of.
Little story of General Lincoln and his and the Battle of Norfolk, where he actually created a battle plan and executed it to capture the city of Norfolk in the summer of 1862. I love that story as well.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is Rise to Greatness. David Vondrelli, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
David Vondrelli is the editor-at-large at Time Magazine and the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. I spoke with him back in February of this year. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.